It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 375. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me questions and suggestions for future show topics. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. Phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show, all one word, on Skype. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show, and also send me a friend request on Facebook, facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. I have a jam-packed show tonight, lots to talk about, but a couple announcements first. One, if you are anywhere near the Philadelphia suburbs area, this Saturday is the first meeting that I am the leader for a new special interest group at the Philadelphia Area Computer Society. They meet in Willow Grove, a real nice venue, which is the community center on the second floor of the Giant in Willow Grove. Great venue. I'm in the main room the very first week that I am the leader for this group. We're going to kick off the Windows Tips and Tricks SIG, and I'm really excited about getting that going and talking about all the tips and tricks to make you more productive, sort of a live extension of the Mike Tech Show, and I'm looking forward to that and hope that I can also record some of those presentations and get them up on YouTube. I'm going to do my best. It's hard to get that done. I need some help, someone there to help set up. This week, I don't have much help, so I'm going to hope for the following month. And they meet the third Saturday of every month. It's only $10 to join the user group. Well worth it for everything that you get. So hoping that some of you can make it out there. I promise I will get the links to the YouTube videos that was posted up for my presentation at the Ewing Computer Learning Center. And I think there's two videos posted already. I will make sure that the links are in the show notes for them. Before the show tonight, I was at a client that needed just a simple upgrade for their Peachtree accounting software. So you figure this is no problem. They have the Peachtree Complete Accounting 2009. It's running on a Windows 7 Ultimate 64-bit. They're part of a network there where I have 20 workstations and a small business server 2008. The data is stored on the server, and everything's running great, but they need to upgrade to the newest version, 2012. And we've been putting it off for a couple months. They finally closed the books for the one fiscal year, and they're ready to go to the new version. So I figured this is only a couple minutes. The data is all backed up on the server, so we pop the... See, that's when we know there's going to be problems, when we go in there thinking it's only going to be a minute. Pop the DVD in, the upgrade starts, and it gets to the final part, which is like step three of three after about, 5 or 10 minutes. And the bar goes all the way to the end, but we never get a finish. It just doesn't finish. And I waited, gave it way too much time. Click cancel. It wouldn't close. So I had to go into Task Manager, close the whole installer. And we figured, let's try it again. Only this time, some of the lessons learned... When you're running Windows 7, sometimes certain install programs and setup, you got to right-click and pick Run as Administrator. So I do that, pick Run as Administrator, it stops at the same point. I said, you know what? Time for tech support for Sage Peachtree Accounting. So for Sage Peachtree. So I call them up and we wait. And then I finally get through, give them the customer number. And the guy says, yeah, you're supposed to, you know, you could wait a long time. I said, we waited a long time. And I said, you want me to wait an hour? And he says, well, it may take that long. I said, you know what? If you really don't want to help me, how about kicking me up to someone who's going to help me? He said, all right, let's try a few things. So he had me kill the program and start uninstalling everything. I uninstalled everything, and the uninstall would not finish properly. So he remotes in. So Citrix Go to Assist he uses, has me go to a website. He connects in, and he starts deleting the registry keys for the program. He sees the old version. We start renaming directories, and I'm watching everything he's doing. He still can't uninstall it. So he downloads Revo, uninstaller, finishes, cleans it. Everything looks like it's uninstalled. We reboot the system. He logs back in. We start to install the program, and it stops at the very same spot. I said, why don't you look in the knowledge base at the company there? This has got to be a common problem. He looks, he comes back and says, we need to change the permissions of a registry key for Windows Installer. I had my doubts on this because the person is a local administrator. We're on a network, but I've put this user in the administrator, local administrators group, and she has full permissions to the system. He changes the key. We have to uninstall everything. Back to Revo, cleans it out, starts the install, and would you know that program installed, and it went through. So the lesson learned here, even though you're an administrator, this program got hung up in copying files from the CD and did not copy all of the files. Now, the permissions on the key were for local administrators, full control. The user had full control, and users were read, and yeah, I don't think they had full control or modify. It was just users were read. But administrators and the local administrator group had full control. He had to change the key to be everyone full control. Now, I never like giving everyone full control of anything, but you know, you always want to just read and write access, but never the full control. But it's just one little key in the registry for the installer, and he changed those permissions and then populated it through the rest of the key. So we went to advanced, made sure everyone was there, checked the box for everything below, and that fixed it. I mean, it was very clear after making that change, the install worked. And that's why I'm taking the time to bring that up. Because how often do you run into a program, and I think this is just bad programming on Peachtree's part for their installer. I mean, you're already an admin on the box, and you're telling me your program can't copy all the files? And the first time it failed, I even disabled the semantic endpoint protection, making sure that, hey, maybe that's interfering. It was just one of those things, and they absolutely had the answer. A couple lessons learned here. Don't be afraid to call the manufacturer for the software. And if you buy a new version, especially of Peachtree, you get one free call for the install, you know, if you run into an install problem. So take advantage of that and use it, because there was no way I was going to spend hours and hours trying to solve this. And it already was a 3-hour process just to install Peachtree. Now, earlier in the week, a client also has Peachtree, but it was installing new on a brand new computer. Now, they had their data they were already using, data generated for 2012. Not a problem. Now, a couple lessons on Peachtree here, since someone in the chat room is going to install. 2009 Peachtree allows you to browse to another location and bring up data from a network drive into Peachtree. You can't do that. And they started it with 2011 and maintained it on 2012. And I didn't know this. You have to have the data running on another system that has Peachtree or the pervasive SQL database already running. You cannot grab data that's on another location that does not have Peachtree. So here's what we had to do. I had the data stored on a network drive. We had to move the data to a subdirectory called company that the program sets up for the data. I dropped that in there, and the tech told me there's a .loc file. If you change the location of data on a Peachtree data, you must delete the .loc file. I don't like deleting any files. Rename it to .old or something like that, or move it to another directory. Peachtree automatically creates that file. A couple things here. If you're going from 2011 to 2012, you're probably good as long as the data is going to be in the same location. The upgrade and the conversion of the data, the first time you load the company data, it was interesting that it has to convert the data to every year before it gets to 2012. So we had 2009 data. It had to upgrade to 2010. And then I watched it upgrade to 2011 version. And then it upgraded to the 2012. That went very, very fast. It was very simple. Once we established we could get into all of the companies, and there's two company files here that we had to get into, then I went through the backup process that I want my client to do, where they're backing it up to a network share that then is being backed up on the server. So I didn't want to lose that process with backing up, because now that they're not pulling the data directly from the network share, I don't want them to have a workstation crash or something to happen and the data is not backed up. So a couple things that I wanted to share with you, and there's lots of little tidbits throughout this whole discussion that you may come across on maybe another software product that you're installing. And the big thing here is to make sure all data, you know the exact directory path of any accounting program or any program that has a database like this, that you got to make sure that the data, you know exactly where the path is and that it's copied and that you don't have a problem. Now, Kate in the chat brought up about the .NET framework failed to install. Interesting that .NET framework 3.51 SP1 was installed as part of the 2012 Peachtree install. Certainly after it was installed once, every time after that, it went a lot faster through the .NET framework. But two things that I hate always running into is the .NET framework and the visual C++ redistributable files. You know, those two, you know, are the problem areas of them not behaving properly when everybody's using different versions of the .NET framework and their software, and you have to clean it up. And on previous shows, we've talked about some great utilities to help clean up the .NET framework mess that can happen on workstations. A couple other things here. That one, I can't wait to start playing with the following software. When I was given my presentation at the Ewing Computer Learning Center, they have labs that have lots of computers that anybody can come in and use. And one of the things they have installed is a program that will automatically image the system when you reboot it. So anybody can come in and do anything they want to kill the system. When they reboot it, it's automatically imaged, and they use Komodo Time Machine. Now, I've heard of Komodo for security, but I have never heard of the Time Machine program. It's free. If any of you have used it, let me know. And if you're hearing this for the first time, give it a try, because the way they have it implemented is very cool. And especially, I could see this for any kind of a lab environment where, or machines that are available to the public, or a library. You know, there's lots of places that you can implement this. I was very impressed. What led them to this, of course, was so many times they had to redo the systems, and it was taking so long to maintain them. They had to put a process in place that made it very, very easy to re-image the system and not have any worries. And if you're in that situation, take a look at the Komodo Time Machine. For the next segment, I want to discuss Hamachi. It's been a long time. Log Me In purchased them a while ago. Hamachi software was and still is a free VPN software that you can download and install on machines and create a private, virtual private network between a set of computers and systems that you can now securely remote desktop or access an internal web server or some services that you do not want to make public. So if you're in the need of a VPN, Hamachi is a great alternative to the traditional hardware VPN. Normally, and you still can use this, there's lots of great and expensive, and I know there's inexpensive solutions, but your typical VPN was a hardware device that was a hardened firewall, a hardened security device that you would then have client software. You would connect in by your software making a secure connection that you authenticated to on this device, and now you have an encrypted tunnel to the private network. You now have a computer that is directly on the network. So here's the problem a client of mine, or I should say a new client, runs into. He has a small office that gets flooded during one of the rainstorms last week. And this flood makes it to where they cannot work in the office, but the server, which is really just a peer workstation, and some of the other equipment is up high enough and protected from the water, including their phone system, so that's all running. So now, while they pump out the water and they, you know, you got the smell and you got to change the carpets and all, you got all kinds of work where a couple workers cannot be there, but they need their phone system and they need access to the phone system. So they have a voice over IP phone system that is an appliance-based system, and they have hard, you know, regular handsets, VoIP handsets, but it's all set for local within that office. How do we get those extensions and those phones to work outside of the office, so they can be at home and answer the phone and do this in a secure fashion that's connected in to the office? The phone company recommended, you know, you got to set up a VPN, buy a hardware VPN router at one end, put the router at the other end for the person who needs it, set up that tunnel, boom, you're in, plug the phone in to a network jack on the router that you just bought, and it works. I had a better idea. I said, do we have a soft client, a software-based phone client for the phone system that you can put on the laptop, put a headset on it, we use a software VPN solution, and voila, you're connected, and you have your phone system? And they said, that should work. So he gets the soft phone client, gets it configured on a laptop, takes the laptop off site, and now we got to get Hamachi working. And Hamachi, I have not used in a long, long time, certainly since LogMeIn took them over. And it's free for non-commercial use for up to 16 computers. It's also free for commercial use, but for a trial 14-day period. So if you're a commercial client, you can use it free for 14 days, but then you got to purchase it. I think it's $200 for the year, and it lets you install the client on 256 computers. If you're in a situation where you need a software-based VPN, this could be the solution. There's three types of networks that you can create when you install Hamachi. One is a gateway virtual networking, which we're going to talk about because that's what my client had to deploy. You have the hub and spoke virtual network, which provides remote users with a secure access to specific computers on the network from any location. And this is without modifying the firewalls or network routers, which makes it easy to deploy. Now, the gateway installation provides remote users with secure access to the private network and LAN, including the resources on it, from a centralized LogMeIn gateway. The third is a mesh network, which connects all of the network clients to each other. Everybody that has the client will be connected in one big, happy virtual private network. So we took the Hamachi client and set it up as a gateway on his peer server in his network closet. We configured that as the gateway, and now that software will hand out IP addresses when you install the Hamachi client on another computer outside the network and you give it the login information. So you, like LogMeIn, you set this up with an email address and a password. And then to join a network, you get a unique network ID. Now you write that network ID down and you can set it up very simply online to have a password to automatically join the network. So we pick a password, nice secure password, and we get the network ID. I test it with my laptop. Now, I don't have the soft phone client on my laptop, but I connect in and I can now see the gateway computer and all the services. But now I'm confused on how to access that VoIP appliance. And when you hear how clever this gateway setup is, if you have a network that's 192.168, let's say .1, dot whatever, and let's say the gateway is .10. So the machine that you're installing it on, its local IP address is 192.168.1.10. So it's receiving IP addresses from the router that are on that subnet. When you connect, the system, the gateway software, will automatically assign you an IP address on that subnet. Once you're on there, I looked at my local IP address and it said the gateway was 10.40.1.10. I said, how can that be? It's a 192. The Hamachi software is intelligent enough to detect that you locally may have the same IP address scheme. And to make sure there's no conflicts, it takes the first two octets of the IP address and adds a 10 dot network to it. So in my case, it went 10.40. So if I'm at a remote system with the client running and I want to access a server that's behind this gateway on that network, and let's say it's 192.168.1.250, I would navigate to that by browsing, or however you get access to the server, I would put 10.40.1.250. So you keep the last two octets the same, but the first two are now 10 dot whatever you see for the network. And in my case, it was 10.40. Now, I don't know if it does 10.40 for everybody when it sees a 192.168. It may be 10 dot something else. But I like how they do that. So I was able to browse the appliance that is the voice server on the network. He was able to connect by putting the IP address in the soft client as 10.40.1.250 and is able to connect in. It's a great solution. They have excellent documentation on LogMeIn, the site. I'll have links to those explanations of how to deploy Himachi and use it. I'll have them in the show notes. I wanted to share that because lots of times I want a quick, easy way, or someone needs an easy way to maybe remote into their network. And we all know that RDP, which is great to use, it's not a secure protocol and secure client to use across the public internet to access workstations and servers. What you got to do is create this virtual private network that is secure and then run those applications like RDP over that. And now you have a secure way to access resources on a network. And if it's for non-commercial use, it is free. So you can have 16 systems. Now, if you're going to go more than 16, then you got to pay the piper and fork over the $200. But, you know, if you're in a commercial business and you need access to your services, that's not a big price to pay considering what the price of hardware is. Now, something I've been reading, if you go commercial, supposedly they don't squeeze the bandwidth, so to speak. So if you're paying the commercial rate, you have faster access across this VPN, where if you're using the free, you don't quite get the performance that you would if you paid the money for the commercial. And you want to consider that. So take a look at what you're trying to access and what you're doing. I will say this, at the very least, it's worth using to deploy and test in lieu of a hardware solution for the VPN. You want to give it a try, because if it works and you're happy with the performance, win, win, win. And you can save a ton of money. But again, if it's not and you don't have the performance, then you need to look into a hardware solution. There's lots of hardware-based solutions out there where, you know, you can go Cisco by paying a ton of money, and then you got more reasonably priced with good performance, Safe at Home, Safe at Office, I believe it's called, where they have routers and VPNs, hardware. Just something to consider, and something that certainly you should look at playing with to get access to your own network at home. I mean, I have that on my server now, and I have this on my laptop. So when I'm outside of my home office network, I can access everything and it works great. And I'm happy with the performance for non-commercial use. So check out Himachi from LogMeIn and try to deploy it, play with it, use it, and let me know how you made out and how it's working for you. And if you're already a user of it, let me know how you like it and what you're doing with that software-based VPN. All right, let's get to some email. This is from Brendan, and he says, I need a wireless card for my PC as I need to hook it into my home network. My motherboard is an MSI 790FX GD70. And has a few PCI and PCIe slots, and would like a recommendation on what is a good card to buy, as I'm currently having connection issues while gaming over a wireless connection on said computer with an ASUS wireless card. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Thanks. Brendan, you are not going to like my answer. I am not a gamer, but I do have sons that are gamers on the Xbox 360 and other devices. And there's one thing I've learned, at least from my house, is that true gaming on a wireless connection, does not work right. You're not going to get the proper ping response from the servers that are hosting the games. You want a wired connection. Do whatever it takes to bring a wired connection to your gaming rig. Wireless, and I know I'm going to hear from people that use wireless all the time and they swear by it. Well, you're lucky and good, and keep it up and keep using it. And as long as you're happy with it, great. Me, what I've seen, you don't use wireless for gaming. You need a wired connection. You can look into other wireless devices, and I recommend, hey, go USB. There are lots of inexpensive USB wireless adapters, but Brendan, I don't think you're going to like that. So this is really for anybody else that has a traditional desktop that they want to add wireless capability. Don't forget about just a USB wireless. I've had good luck with the MonoPrice one that does G and end, and it's $9.99, and it's USB, and that's just at monoprice.com. I've used that for clients. Are they doing gaming with it? Absolutely not. But Brendan, try to do whatever it takes to get a hard wire to your machine. This is from Kevin, and he says, "Hi, Mike. My name is Kevin, and I recently moved back to Virginia. My job includes working in DC and traveling the world doing what is basically network admin for the U.S. State Department. I've wanted to say a big, big thank you for a long time now, as this is a job that I landed partly due to the advice from the job interview show you did a number of years ago." Very cool. Thank you. "Though I consider myself as someone who keeps his home network fairly locked down and clean, once in a while, something unwanted slips by. Attached are screenshots of problems that has popped up recently on my Sony Vaio laptop running Windows 7. Now, he goes into some screenshots and some problems, and he's tried Super Anti-Spyware, Avist, Avira, Malwarebytes, all with no indication that there is something wrong with his machine. And I haven't been able to find any exact indication online as to whether or not this is truly a virus or some type of malware, or just something that would let a virus or malware into my computer. I was wondering if you or any of your listeners might be able to provide some advice." He gives me permission to send his email on the air, but I'm not going to do that. Here's what I've recommended. A couple basic things that you can do when you have some abnormal anomalies happening on your computer. One, run CombiFix. You know it's my favorite spyware killer out there. Run CombiFix. And remember, when you're looking for CombiFix, you Google bleeping computer combo space CombiFix. Then I want you to run msconfig, go to startup, and shut off by unchecking all the unnecessary programs that are loading. There's a lot of things in there, and you know what? Don't be afraid to uncheck everything, for at least to see what's going on. Next, clean out all those temp files. Lots of viruses hide in the nooks and crannies of temp files within a system, and I love the TFC Temp File Cleaner by Old Timer. It's a program I use all the time, and it goes in and cleans out all those temp files. And that might be the first thing to run, because the more you eliminate all the temp files, the faster those spyware programs will run, like a CombiFix, because it will have less to check because you've already cleansed it of all the junk. I emailed Kevin those ideas and waiting to hear back, and hopefully that helps you and it eliminates some of the things that are popping up and the problems that you're experiencing. This is from Jonathan, and he says, "Where can I get the old Mike Tech Show podcast, like show number 1 to 351? Very simple. Go to the wiki, at mtswiki.com. And it's very clear. You have links to all of the past shows, and you can click on the link, and it will take you to the show notes and to the audio. A couple responses from the last couple shows where I talked about the saving of passwords. And this is a response for saving passwords in the cloud. And this is from Matthew, and he says, "Longtime listener, I really enjoy your show. I just finished listening to show 372 where you talked about saving passwords in the cloud. You are correct. LastPass did have an issue in May 2011. But the proper precautions in place, a strong master password, and use of a second authentication factor like YubiKey, most people unfortunately don't have that second authentication like YubiKey. And that complicates your life. I do not believe there was any harm done." Well, you're now, just to be fair, Matthew, you're taking some really big extra steps that the typical user does not take. "I was first turned on to LastPass when Steve Gibson reviewed the service on episode 256 of Security Now and gave it his stamp of approval. After LastPass made public the problem, Steve looked into the issue on Security Now episode 301, and he explained what happened and the risk to the users. Steve said the worst case scenario is that the bad guys got the hash that LastPass uses to authenticate users and the encrypted data. Since LastPass does not store the master password on their servers, all decryption is done on the local machine. So only via a brute force attack could an attacker gain access to the saved passwords. Therefore, in Steve's assessment, the only way a user was at risk to be compromised was if they used a weak master password. Last I heard, he is still using the service. While I agree that we should be very careful about storing passwords in the cloud, with good security practices, we can protect our data on third-party servers." He is absolutely correct. Your password should be a minimum of 8 characters. It should not be a common word, and you should mix in upper and lower case, a number, and a symbol. If you do all of that, that is a complex enough password that definitely will help you probably for 99% of any kind of issues where someone would have to exhort to a brute force attack. So thank you, Matthew, for following up with that and that information. This is another one by Roy on the same topic. And he says, "I had the same problem raised by clients and by myself, needs the need of making your password available only, and on the other hand, the concern from trusting the online service provider with your sensitive data. I found a solution that is working for me and for my clients, and I want to share it with you and the Mike Tech Show listeners. The idea is very simple. You use the online storage, the data synchronization of all service providers, but you make the data that is stored on the cloud to be encrypted. This way, if someone is hacking the servers and it is trying to steal your data, he can't do anything with it because it's encrypted. I use the set of TrueCrypt plus KeePass plus Dropbox. I've uploaded the portable version of KeePass to the Dropbox folder. So if I am using some random computer, I can download it and use it to decrypt the KeePass file. You can use other services, but the main idea stays the same. I know that the portability of the data is not perfect, but it is working." Yes, if you encrypt your data and it's stored in the cloud, then your data, if it's compromised, they have to break that encryption. And I completely agree with that. And you should absolutely have your data encrypted. Also, if you're backing up to external drives, you should be deploying TrueCrypt to encrypt that external drive in case you lose it or that USB stick. Also, take advantage of backup programs that allows encryption. Yes, encryption is a hassle, and security is a hassle, but it's there. It's definitely, security is inconvenient. It's like when they search you and pat you down to get on an airplane. It's inconvenient, but it's for your own good. And yes, security is an inconvenience, but you need to do that and to encrypt your data and take advantage of encryption with backup software that allows it, where maybe you got to just turn it on. It might just be a checkbox and you give it a password one time. So now if you ever have to restore that data, you need the password that you selected. Keep all of this in mind when you go to store your data, whatever the program is, whatever the service is, and wherever the location is. And that is the main point. This is from Christopher. I've started listening to your show for the past 2 months and really appreciate the work you put into it. I work full-time for a company as a remote support specialist and for years have contemplated starting a side technology solutions business. Your information has helped motivate me to get started. My question is for one of my clients. They use Lotus Notes. Don't ask. They want to export their email folders to be able to view them without notes. Any free third-party programs or solutions would be much appreciated. Thanks again. So I don't know, is there a Lotus Notes viewer? Or is there a way that you can export the Lotus Notes email into a format that is then readable? Now, if you were an Outlook user, I would say you can use any export of an email to, it's a .eml file, which is really a text file that you could then look with any program that can read a text file. Look for ways to export the folders and the email within Lotus Notes. I'm not a Lotus Notes user, so I don't know. It's been a long, long time, and I don't remember some of the details for notes, but do we know of a Lotus Notes viewer out there that we can recommend for Christopher? Let me know. Email me, miketechshow@gmail.com, and I will pass it along. Final email, and this is from Mark, and he says, this is for the side-by-side error I was receiving last week for a client. And he says, Mike, your problem with the side-by-side error you talked about on Tech Vets number 60 and the Mike Tech Show 374 reminds me of an old problem I had with MS Office 97 and an Excel template that would not run on one of the 80 corporate laptops that our field techs were using. All 80 were originally loaded from a master corporate image. The error was complaining about a DLL needed by Office. Deleting and reloading Office got the same error. Check the DLL for virus and revisions. Everything seemed okay. The DLL turned out to be a newer version than any of the other 79 laptops. Some other program, I don't remember its name, had loaded the newer version. Kind of reminds me of the article a long time ago by Brian Livingston called DLL Hell. Anyway, I just brought that to mind. Because the other program was needed by the tech and the DLL was newer, I left that DLL in the Windows subdirectory. I then added the DLL needed for the Excel template to its subdirectory. Problem solved. Well, I didn't get into that level of detail of the specific DLL that might have been causing the side-by-side error. My solution was to restore the system, which I successfully did this week, and it was a much shorter time to resolve the problem by just making sure the data was backed up. He backed it up to an external drive, and I restored everything from the partition on the compact laptop. And since we didn't need any DVDs or CDs or any media, he had that recovery partition. It went very, very smoothly. I mean, I had very little applications to install, really only Office and Firefox, and then reloaded his data. 2 hours, done, from beginning to end of the whole process, where I had spent 4 to 5 hours just trying to solve that error. Sometimes you got to cut your losses and just redo the system. And you know, I don't like doing that up front. But if you go down that path where you're spending just way, way, way too much of your time, you got to look for that other solution. And you know, you just got to give up, wave the white flag, surrender, redo the system. Sometimes that's the better option. And you know, I don't like that. I have to admit, you know, when it comes to time and time's money, you have to make that decision and make that call. One thing before I wrap up, if you are buying anything from Amazon, stop. And I want you to think, I got to go to Mike Tech Show's link, amazon.mikenation.net, miketechshow.com/Amazon. Both of them will take you right to Amazon and my link, and I'll get credit for anything you're buying, no matter what it is. It doesn't even have to be computer related, and I'll get a commission. And I appreciate everybody who's supporting the show using my Amazon links. Thank you. That is it for tonight's show. I will be back same time, same channel next week. And have a great weekend. Have a great week. Email me your questions and stay subscribed. And thank you for all your support. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.